This episode of AVXL was recorded on June 28th, 2018. Welcome to AVXL. We're going to talk about Samsung building OLEDs, balanced audio cables, why DNS rebinding took out your favorite voice automation preamps, OLED burn-in, and so much more.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home video and audio gear. No matter what your budget is, we love stereo audio. We love surround sound. We love home theater. We love beautiful, crisp imagery from the best possible source. And most of all, we love you having the best possible experience you can have when enjoying your favorite tunes and your favorite movies and TV shows. Or just, if you're like me, obsessed with Graham Norton's drunken celebrity interviews, or occasionally stone sober celebrity interviews, and
oh man,
Carpool Karaoke, man.
Oh, cool.
Have you seen the new series of Carpool Karaoke?
No.
Search for it on YouTube.
I mean, I see them there occasionally.
Anybody who can drop Paul McCartney into a pub as a cover band is all right with me.
Okay. That, I will say, within like a day or two, that particular video had like 15 million views. There was clearly a good one.
Even if you're not a huge Beatles fan, even if you don't like the Beatles, it's totally worth watching, you know.
That guy's seen some things.
That guy's seen some things. And people react to Paul McCartney.
Sir?
They'd probably, Sir Paul McCartney. I apologize to Sir Paul McCartney.
Have been knighted? One of the Bee Gees just got knighted too. Forgive me for not remembering which BG it was.
To the crown, perhaps.
Oh, man.
we often talk about hardware and software and video delivery and television screens and projectors, and we're going to talk about all about that. But
and you are Patrick Norton.
I am Patrick Norton.
And I am Robert Herron.
Yeah, I guess we normally introduce ourselves before I wander
just
off.
Just in case for the new listeners out there.
Oh, my goodness.
Welcome to AVXL.
Oh my goodness. You know, it's everything was going fine this morning until a friend of mine, Michael from Beginner Audiophile, forwarded around a video of a ska band covering Rage Against the Machine.
That's probably pretty good.
It is glorious. I'm just going to say that right now, but we'll talk about that in the whole what we're watching later on in the episode. Because then I'll go right down that rabbit hole again and put all of y'all to sleep. OLED, we think of LG.
Yes.
LG's now become, I want to say, I think LG's become the second supplier of OLED screens for phones to to Apple. Boy, I'm going to wake up eventually.
Well, and, no, Samsung makes the OLED panel, the best OLED panels for mobile devices, including those integrated into everything from the iPhone X to even the Pixel 2 phone.
Yeah,
well, not the Pixel 2 XL. That actually used an LG OLED, mm-hmm. but the Pixel 2 actually did use a Samsung panel.
Yeah,
and they're my absolute favorite when it comes to a mobile OLED device. Ever since the Galaxy S3, I have been kind of, you know, addicted to that image quality. And I every time I go back to an LCD of any kind, it's just not the same.
I notice the disappointment in your face every time you look at my iPhone 6.
I have plenty of good value phones with LCD screens that I actually like a lot. But when it comes to what I want to carry around,
looking at them,
it's that late night when I'm sitting there in the dark or laying there in bed and I can look at the phone.
Right.
The black level of OLED just. It soothes my eyes.
You know, in a peculiar development, LG is now supposed to supply Apple with somewhere between 2 and 4 million OLED panels for this year's iPhone X Plus.
Interesting.
But we normally think of LG as being, you know, the television OLED manufacturer.
Right.
And now you've caught some stories that are suggesting that Samsung is working on an OLED TV. Like, I thought they were going to solve it with quantum dots, or are they just, is it too attractive to move in that direction?
No, and to be clear, too, Samsung did put out one OLED television back in the day, and it was a gloriously expensive beast of a TV, but that was a one-off, and they quickly retreated and said, you know what, the technology, in our opinion, is not ready yet, and for the last few months, there have been several reports now, and this is strictly rumor at this point, that Samsung is busy working on a new OLED technology for use in televisions and not for mobile displays. So one of the interesting things about the rumor mill as it goes around, and this is coming from folks like OLEDinfo.com, flatpanelshd.com. There are articles going all the way back to, I want to say, February, in terms of when the story started first trickling out. ET News out of Korea is another one who was probably the first to jump on this. They're saying that Samsung is developing a blue OLED backlight plane. They're combining that then with a quantum dot enhanced color filter to produce an OLED TV.
And interesting.
This is similar in a way to LG's development of OLED in the sense that they use a white OLED material that drives through a color filter, a red, blue, green color filter to produce the imagery we see. Actually, I take that back. Red, blue, green, and white. There is a white subpixel to the OLED panels as well. Now, we've been waiting for LCDs to incorporate quantum dot enhancements into the color filter of mm-hmm. those displays. Currently, they're doing it with a separate layer that pushes the backlight through it. It would be nice to just integrate that directly into the subpixels themselves as far as the quantum dot enhancement goes. And if this rumor pans out, this technology is likely coming along quite nicely. Now, back at Display Week 2018 a few weeks ago, Nanosys, the quantum dot masters here in California, they were touting a new technology called QDOG, which was their quantum dot on glass. One of the things about QDOG in particular was that they were able to produce the quantum dot materials on a glass plane using printable technologies, which was a big deal. It didn't require vacuum chambers right. and vapor deposition and things like that. Compared to that white OLED material used in LG's TVs, Samsung is actually, at least if the rumors are true, they will skip that white subpixel in favor of having just red, blue, green subpixels only. In this case, it would be a clear subpixel for the blue subpixel, along with red and green quantum dot enhanced subpixels. If they have a blue backlight plane that is robust enough to survive for 10 years, say,
right,
to half brightness, whatever the metric is, that would produce, in my opinion, an even better OLED panel than we're currently seeing. You would get away from the white subpixels used in LG displays. Mm-hmm. This would probably then suggest that you could do even a wider color palette, something well beyond DCI currently, probably approaching Rec 2020. It really will come down to how robust that blue material is. I'm expecting to see something, hopefully, at CES, perhaps behind closed doors. We will find out. I'm looking forward to it. We needed some competition in the OLED space. If Samsung can do the double whammy in terms of creating a solid OLED system with quantum dot enhancements, that to me is just going to suggest that it's going to have superb color, very efficient, very bright. Hopefully we'll see something in the line of like maybe a 1500 nit OLED within the next year or two.
That would be pretty impressive.
It would be.
You know, given that, you know, we're looking for 4,000 and eventually 10,000 nits for sort of a full HDR experience.
But well, the spec for HDR is different for displays in terms right. of LCDs versus OLEDs. OLEDs are given a break on the absolute brightness because they can do black almost perfectly.
Right. And they then have absolute, yeah.
yeah. And then in the case of LCDs, they're given, the spec allows them to have a slightly brighter black level, but they have to then pump at least 1,000 nits. So, or actually, I think it's probably like 800 plus or something like that. But anyway, we're already seeing TVs hitting 2,000 plus now. So
they're getting bright.
I am just looking forward to seeing this happen because it sounds like a good way to do it. It's not quite the same as having that original Samsung TV. Their original OLED actually used red, blue, and green materials. The problem with using three separate colors for the subpixels for the OLED material is that they age differently. And you could have uneven wear over the years where, say, your blue wears faster than the red and the green. So hopefully with this formulation they're coming up with for this blue backplane for the mm-hmm. Samsung OLED, rumor, it could turn out to be one of the very best panels in terms of OLED performance in that ultra thin and flat design we love so much.
I'm all for more performance.
Heck yeah.
Shannon ordered in the Amazon Fire TV Cube to review on Tech Thing.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, she's pretty excited, but she's deeply invested in the Amazon Echo / ALEXA. And at some level, this is primarily an Echo with a Fire TV built into it. Well, it's a glass cube. Right? We talked about it.
It's got a Sirius IR blaster. It has CEC control.
Mm-hmm.
It is an interesting home theater product that could make for, I think, just a simplified setup.
Yeah.
It can basically handle things like Harmony's universal remote control characteristics in addition to CEC control, which at the very least on a TV with CEC control built in and audio return channel and all that good stuff.
It's more about IR than CEC or audio return channel. I think I don't, you know, if you want to see Shannon's full review, she is running a full Harmony remote system at home.
Oh,
she's
cool.
Got a Roku box. She's not running 4K or HDR, so she wasn't doing any testing on that. But what was crazy about it, setup was fine. Treating it like an ALEXA was fine because it just sits there and waits for you to talk to it. Amongst other oddities, there's no volume control on the remote.
Hmm.
You know, even Apple eventually put a volume control on the remote of the Apple TV.
Oh, this actually includes a remote control with it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Well, I mean, do you want to turn the volume down on something you're watching by going, ALEXA,
no.
Reduce volume, reduce no. volume. Reduce volume, you know what I mean? So
volume 3, volume 4, yeah, usually what I'm doing.
You're either going to keep your, yeah, I mean, but, you know, that to me does not sound like an optimal movie or television watching experience, but I also may be, you know, profoundly old school. But, you know, it's in terms of being a pure Harmony remote replacement, it's not there. If you are trying to integrate voice automation into a single component, certainly that is kind of the target for it.
Okay.
But
I was going to say, if you did do the CEC-enabled control, then at least you'd be able to use another remote that does have a volume control on it.
Yeah, but, you know, how many remotes? If we're trying to eliminate all the remotes, it's really frustrating to have to keep all the remotes nearby.
keep my Harmony Ultimate at hand.
Yeah, I mean, she said it did a pretty good job with controlling most of everything she was set into it. What it won't do is, she said it was slow, and it was, you know, if she was looking to watch specific content on the Fire TV, it was great. But if she needed to switch to another device, then it becomes somewhat less capable. So,
gotcha. It's not quite a Harmony replacement yet with
no.
ALEXA built in.
Yeah. But it is, if you are deeply invested in Amazon Prime and the Amazon ecosystem, it probably would be a natural choice. If you don't have a Harmony remote and you're looking to take the next step, or you're obsessed with bringing Alexa into another, room in your home.
That was my opinion of the Sonos Beam with its ALEXA support built in the sense that it was great with, say, like an Amazon Fire TV Stick.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the additional functionality you could eke out of it, in terms of being able to directly request certain programs and things that were within Amazon's video ecosystem. However, with other devices or even other inputs, it was less than capable. However, this also really depends on the capabilities of your TV as well. If you have an ALEXA-enabled TV, then chances are you would have additional control functionality. I'm thinking specifically of like Vizio TVs, the latest ones. With their ALEXA app, you can then do other things in addition to the regular controls like volume up, volume down, power on, power off. You could also then select inputs and probably even picture modes and other things like that. It's all targeting a good way to do voice control within a home theater for relatively little money. And that to me is important. A good way to get it going in a way that could help a lot of people, I think, just in terms of basic usage. Also, too, once you have a TV hooked up like that and you can just walk into the room and say, blah, 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 TV on.
Right.
That gets pretty addictive. Or you're laying there at night and, you know, you don't even want to open your eyes to find the remote. It's like, blah, 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 TV off. Done. That
you know,
to me is. It goes a long way.
I'm finally starting to experiment with
I have this thing about having always-on listening devices. That's the other thing. I frequently just turn off the mic on a lot of those devices.
Oh, man.
If they're going to be in the room for long term.
Well, I'm experimenting with both Home and Echo in the garage right now because I'm not ready for, you know, my six-year-old to have full access to home automation. But
not until they add in, like, politeness characteristics where you have to say please and thank you. Why are they waiting on that technology? It's just turning us into, you, do this. You, do that.
Gimme. Well, I think for me, what's interesting about it is I find it incredibly disruptive to speak out loud while we're watching something to change the volume. And I probably change the volume more than the average person for no reason.
I very rarely use voice control for volume control. I find it's just, no, No. Often the control isn't as granular as I'd like it to be.
Right.
Even in the case of Alexa, you can say like volume 7, volume 8, volume 2. That granularity is still not enough to me. It's usually I'm floating between 3 and 4 and it's like, okay, just give me the damn remote. I just a couple notches up, somewhere in between that.
You're driving me crazy. Let us change the subject.
Okay.
What happened with the DNS rebinding? It was an attack. Essentially, it was a weaponized HTML link. So if you clicked on the wrong thing on a web page, you know, your Roku or your Sonos devices would be schwacked or attacked, I should say, via web browsers.
This DNS rebinding vulnerability has been found in virtually every model, according to the Wired article, of devices like Google Home, Chromecast, right. Sonos Wi-Fi speakers, Roku streaming sticks, smart thermostats, and I'm sure...
Oh, and Google Home and Chromecast devices happened a few days before the most of these articles. Well, basically a couple days before the Sonos and the Roku attacks came out. Are they basically taking over the DNS links for a particular device? The DNS, if you're not familiar with the domain name service, is the thing that allows you to type in www.avxl.com instead of like 174.13.22.999 or whatever the IP address we're hosted at is. It's the phone book for the internet.
My understanding is that if you clicked on a link crafted by some malicious entity, they could then, from through your browser, take advantage of local network right. addresses that normally wouldn't be accessible to the outside world.
Got it.
And it's effectively...
Nice hack.
Yeah, it's effectively leveraging that trust built into that connection between you and your web browser and saying, oh, okay, you've clicked on this. Now we can start to ping your devices from within the home on addresses like 192.168 and a couple of the other common addresses that are usually utilized only within the local environment.
Right.
With that going on, they could then start taking advantage of those devices that don't mitigate that kind of an attack.
Turning every single Philips Hue light bulb on that they can reach on the internet, or turning everybody's thermostats. I mean, this was an interesting article that came out in the New York Times where...
I would just say right off the bat, I don't think this is going to affect a lot of people.
Right.
More people are going toward encrypted website connections and other basic things in terms of the web. You would have to click on a malformed link.
Right.
Sent by somebody to get you to even go down this route. But it is possible, and they are working on it. So I think that's good.
Yeah. Well, if you're concerned about this, if you have somebody that clicks on all the things, if you don't want to wait for patches to be created for all these devices, one, you can go up to rebind.network/rebind. Basically, that will detect vulnerable devices. And if you want to protect yourself from DNS rebinding attacks, you can reassign your router to something like the OpenDNS name system.
That's true. I tend to use the Google addresses, the 8.8.8.8 and 8.8.4.
Cloudflare's 1.1.1.1 is pretty good too.
I ran into an issue with that with certain NAS devices. I had switched a lot of things over to use the quad one and the, I think it's 1.0.0.1. I forget exactly what those two are that came up as protected ones. And I had some devices that simply wouldn't work. If you're concerned at all, hit that rebind.network/rebind and do the simulated DNS rebinding attack and have it check through some very common devices that might be out there. Because the last thing you really want is to click on a link and then have somebody turn on your air conditioner and leave it running full blast and add to your bills for no good reason. I'd be curious to know what kind of malicious activity can be done, or if this is more like nuisance style attacks where it's like, wow, they're just screwing with me on all these devices now, turning them on, turning them off, hopefully not bricking any of them, changing volume controls and things like that. Check out that rebinding attack webpage. Give yourself a quick check. There's also a good article over at the Wired website covering that.
I think the biggest issue is just it allows people to bypass your firewall, putting everything inside your network or make everything on your inside into your network available for puttering with.
Exactly.
That's problematic.
Without a doubt. It's something you definitely don't want to have happening. So
yeah, especially if they can do it to your router. That's a whole nother conversation for another day.
Oh, love my Amplify.
Oh, my goodness.
I think it's updated at least once every other month. They have an update pushed to that thing.
So We saw LG's HU, or you saw, I did not see it, LG's HU80KA projector back at CES 2018. That's their laser 4K home theater projector.
Cinebeam, baby.
I got two questions for you. Is it HDR, and how many billions of dollars is it?
$3,000 for this, for a laser 4K projector. And LG did have some promo pricing on their website right now for $2,700. Single chip DLP, 8-segment color wheel, 20,000-hour laser light engine using laser phosphor technology. True 4K resolution. Well, you know, single chip doing its wobulation to create multiple pixels out of that single chip. But you are seeing, if you put up a resolution test pattern, true 4K performance out of that. Smart TV in terms of having apps like Netflix and YouTube built in. And pretty decent audio for a projector. My favorite thing about it is probably the design. It borders on like a commercial industrial-sized rectangular box, basically. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even really look like a projector until you flip open the front lid on it. Then you realize, hey, there's light shooting out of this thing. So one of the cool things is that lid can be used to not only cover the projector in terms of its optics when it's not being used to keep dust off of it, but the inside of that lid, as it folds open, is a mirror. So it can then be used to, say, stand this projector on end.
Oh, wow.
And it's not short throw, but it simply allows for more placement options in terms of, oh, I'd like to just stand it up and set it on the table right here and just have it shoot at the wall. Or I'm going to put it up on the ceiling where I just want to fold the mirror out of the way completely. This thing can work in multiple configurations in terms of where you want to put it. I absolutely love it. In terms of that. And it also has a retractable power cord, which, oh, hell. I don't know why. That impressed me for some reason. But it is literally...
So you can travel with your projector?
It's a rectangular cube, and it really is a neat design, and I absolutely love it. But when it comes to the color performance, it is strictly HD. Rec. 709 color. It is an HDR-compatible projector in terms of its support for HDR10. Not anything else. Not even HLG, as far as I know right now. Although that could probably be updated down the road. So you are getting the resolution, but you are not getting DCI color, at least in terms of a 4K UHD performance.
Who's the primary market for this?
It's just in terms of laser-based projectors with 4K resolution. That's not a bad price at all for that kind of technology. For that, it is unique and neat for that. Perhaps my favorite thing about LG's projectors like this includes even some of their lamp-based ones.
Right.
They incorporate a over-the-air DTV tuner. So my favorite thing to do with some of these projectors, although I might not do it with a $3,000 laser projector, I would do it with their $800 smart projector that uses a lamp, is to simply put this on a tripod, bring it outside, hang an antenna right off the side of it, and then enjoy some outdoor TV viewing. live TV. And considering the summer weather is here in North America, it is a good time to consider these things. So when the lights go down, I pull out the portable screen and get busy.
Oh, my goodness.
But what I would like to see in the next version of this projector would be DCI color, and that will likely require the use of a dual laser system. Red and blue is typically the way a lot of companies are doing it, like Christie Digital and some of their high-end commercial projectors. Even the new Hisense laser 4K projector, that is also using dual color in their premium line of 4K projectors as well. And I'm going to have to ping Hisense, actually. Between the H9 TV and their laser 4K projector, I would... It might be a good time to start getting in some of their products.
Hisense.
It's a pretty fantastic product. And if $3,000 is really out of your price, and if 4K isn't such a big deal in terms of you may not need it or HDR support, they do have lamp-based and laser-based 1080p projectors that are half or a third of what this costs. It's something to consider, especially if you need a good, robust, lightweight, small projector that's perfect for gaming, perfect for... You know, in my opinion, outdoor use or streaming apps or things like that, you know, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth built in. It's a neat, capable design, and I'm digging it.
Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it.
I want one.
Oh, Instagram TV. I think you were more excited about this than I was, but essentially Instagram's decided to create a YouTube competitor.
I don't even know what this is. IGTV. I heard a lot about it, but... It is Instagram television. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the cruelest thing I heard about it is Instagram, wants to sell more advertising or wants to sell more video advertising because it's a better source of revenue. And they have a bunch of stars that want to create larger videos, and they want to compete with YouTube. So one of the observations that was made, it's going to have all of the problems that Facebook and YouTube currently have, because they're not doing anything in terms of, they're not sort of...
providing that video window.
Well, you know.
In a way that's big screen friendly. I don't know.
It's not so much that a lot of most of YouTube's actually watched on cell phones these days, right? The majority of usage.
I watch a hell of a lot of YouTube.
Yeah, and you know pretty much the same thing for Instagram.
Unless I'm in the living room, and then I go through my Roku Ultra,
right,
and watch YouTube that way.
Well, you know, so Instagram's hit like a billion users. They want to create long form video. They're opening it up to their kind of their top Instagram creators. It just seems like it's going to be suffering from a lot of the issues that Facebook has had, no business model, or that YouTube has had in terms of how they're dealing with theft of content and other stuff. I think it's going to be curious to watch.
I have not paid enough attention to really, I mean, I have a basic understanding and very limited use of Instagram. So if this is simply creating a great video channel for the creators on that platform to get their content out, more power to them.
Yeah.
And especially if you're a fan of Instagram, I think this would be pretty cool for you, especially if it makes it easier to see the video content that people are creating.
You know, it's...
That's one of the complaints I have with YouTube is that, man... It all comes down to, in terms of what you see on, in terms of what's being shown to you in the list you scroll through, it comes down to what you've subscribed to. Unless you know what you're looking for, it's not that easy to just discover new stuff in something you may have never even thought of. It's always like, oh, this is really just curated based upon my own selections, and it puts me in a bubble that it's hard to get out of, or hard to explore what people are doing, say, around the world. That's one thing I would like to see it made easier, at least on YouTube's platform. And hopefully, Instagram TV, they do that better. Don't confine me just to the United States. I want to see like the top stuff from everywhere. I don't care if I understand the language or not. I want to see what people are up to.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, it's Instagram skews younger than Facebook, who owns Instagram. A lot of Instagram users don't realize that Facebook owns them. And it's kind of a way to, you know, leverage a lot of the technology I think they put together for their watch online video service. They're not going to dump the long format videos into your Instagram feed. You can kind of link back to them. So your primary audience has access to them, but they're not kind of forced to watch them. I think it's curious. I'm curious if there's going to be any business model, because one of the things that happened when Facebook got serious about video is they didn't really have a way to pay people, and they didn't really have a way for creators to report pirated content, which is a really big problem on YouTube and Facebook for people who make popular videos. So it'll be curious to see what happens with Instagram and how that
I will say the amount of advertising you see now on YouTube has dramatically increased.
Yeah.
And between their own promotion for their own other services like Google TV and you name it, it's you're always being bugged at some point.
Well, but
that's a business model to run the whole system.
Well, also
distributing your video
people
for effectively free.
Yeah, and it's not people like to say data is free, your CDN's free, your storage is free, but the reality is at some point you have to pay for the bandwidth at some level. Part of the reason you're seeing so many ads is I think at some level it probably they're still hoping to drive people into the red video service where you get to an ad free YouTube experience by paying a monthly fee. But
I'm asked every day.
It's because
would you like to try?
Advertising revenue still hasn't quite caught up from the adpocalypse that happened after the unfortunate PewDiePie, you know.
What, people being demonetized?
Yeah. Well, you know, 24-year-old talks unfortunate smack involving fascist organizations, and you know there's a 50% drop in revenue at YouTube. I mean, that's the shortest version of
being the most popular YouTube creator, and there's a lot of pressure there. I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and you know he made jokes he thought was funny, and a lot of people didn't, and advertisers. You know, I talked to a lot of people at VidCon last year that they had lost half their revenue because there had been such a huge advertiser just yanked everything out of YouTube. A lot of advertisers.
They didn't want their ad showing on something that's super controversial,
right,
or just straight up nasty.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
And what happened
and
was
fully understandable. So
a lot of organizations that had been sort of hurling money into YouTube were kind of like, what are we doing? what are we associating our brand with?
They don't want to be caught on the back foot trying to deal with this crap. They'd rather know right up front. It's like, hey, we're pretty certain this creator, you have nothing to fear here. Our ads will blend nicely with their content.
Yeah.
And, you know,
sometimes
it's a work in progress.
Yeah. And advertising on YouTube has always been a work in progress because there's everything from sort of traditional, you know, radio host where the presenter is delivering the advertising information to the incorporation of products into the videos, which now has to be pointed out that they're sponsors. And it's been an interesting evolution to watch.
I find the advertising on YouTube, at least, has become better in terms of if it's going to show me an ad, it shows me an ad somewhat related to what it is I'm watching. Like, I watch a lot of car-related content on YouTube, so I get a lot of car advertisements. Or when I watch the DIY channels for home renovation or whatever, I get like, oh, here's a brand new skill saw for this, that, and the other.
I'll be honest with you. I'm probably going to end up paying for YouTube Red simply so that I can show my kids a bunch of Monty Python videos or watch Graham Norton interviews with my wife. My boys only see advertising when we're in a hotel or they're at Grandma and Poppy's house.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's pretty much the only time they ever
see regular TV stuff. So. One of the funniest things I have noticed in terms of YouTube's advertising is that there are some unskippable ads. Yeah. Like, I guess most of them would be. But there's also the 4-second introduction ads. So these companies have to craft something that in 4 seconds, what can you do?
Yeah.
That is memorable and is going to be worth your time to actually get that in front of somebody's eyes. I am seeing people get better and better at doing something within that very short period of time. If I find myself glancing at that for 4 seconds, just to go, what the hell am I looking at? Mm-hmm. I think that's a success right there. It's like, wow. I've been fascinated by the adaptation of these companies, the advertisers, to play within that play field. And hey, if there's a 4-second ad we can squeeze in, and where I find it successful is maybe the ad is actually much longer, but you're allowed to skip it after 4 seconds.
Right.
But they'll make that first 4 seconds something that's like, it'll make you just go, what? And then you sit there and you watch it for a little bit longer. It's an interesting game. And it's, for me, just an interesting way to see how advertisers are adapting to the new world.
The brave new world. Oh, my goodness. We don't normally talk for 20 minutes about YouTube, but when we do.
Hey.
We get businessy.
There's a lot of people watching.
One of the questions we promised to answer a couple weeks ago, will Ethernet HDMI adapters do 18 gigabits per second? Using Ethernet cable to create incredibly long runs instead of HDMI cables, that's been around for a while at 1080p. Shortest possible answer is that they'll definitely do 4K. Some will even do current 4K HDR, it looks like, but not the current HDMI 2.1 18 gigabits per second spec.
True.
So...
In the case of devices like you'll hear HDBaseT, mm-hmm. that's a popular technology for delivering video around the house.
Right.
You can actually go over on Monoprice and look at a whole category of products there. Gets it usually to a single cable design, Ethernet, that will then transmit that video and signaling to your devices at great distances, up to 300 feet, say.
Yeah. And Ineos.com.
But they do use compression, though, above, say, 10.2 gigabit.
And that's...
The chipsets aren't 100% 18 gigabit flowing. No, it's more like 10.2.
Yeah, I mean, the Ineos has a good article, 4K versus 4K, where they basically say that copper can't handle the bandwidth for video over IP at 4K at maximum frame rates.
I don't believe that.
What they're saying is the current 4K systems will either reduce the maximum allowable frame rate from 60 frames per second.
Oh, right.
They will change 4.4.4. 444 color to subsamples 420, which throws away like half the image data.
That's what's on a Blu-ray disc. Range. So
yeah.
I get that in terms of the devices, but to say that you can definitely transmit full HD over a piece of copper, clearly, especially with something like Cat 6, shielded, twisted.
Right.
That can do 600 megahertz, I believe, or 500? Anyway, I believe there is a way there, but those current devices won't do it. However, I think I might have mentioned this before, but there are purchasable today, not cheap, but you can do fiber links from point A to point B with either a pre-terminated kit.
Right.
With like, say, a 70 plus foot run of fiber in the middle that you can hide so easily. It's literally, it looks like a piece of fishing line. And then you have on each end something that can do the full 18 gigabit. And those kits generally are about like $700.
When
it's not cheap, but it is available today if you absolutely need it.
when you start digging into the specs, right, you really need to look close and also take a look at the product reviews if they're available, especially if you're shopping on Amazon. You know, for example, one case, Geffen's 4K Ultra HD extender, or no, this is with StarTex adapter, where the guy purchased Cat 6 shielded cable because Cat 6 is better than Cat 5. You know, why not?
It's got the bandwidth.
It turns out that the twist rates on Cat 6 and Cat 7, what he was told is first of all, it wouldn't work. Called tech support at StarTech, and they were like, oh yeah, you can't use Cat 5 because the wire is so tightly twisted. Basically, the overall length of the copper becomes so long because of the additional twists in the wire.
That is a difference between Cat 5 and 6.
You know, of course, the next review on Amazon was like 4 stars and was using Cat 6 cables. You know, it's not 330 feet, although that's mentioned in a lot of the titles on the product titles on Amazon. StarTech says like 35 meters or 115 feet if you use non-proprietary Cat 5e or Cat 6 cabling. Geffen, if you get into their spec, Geffen's kind of been one of the standards for years for video adapters of various types. They can do HDMI up to 495 feet, but the lengths drop, I think, with 4K Cinema DCI. But if you go to 4K Ultra HD, it's like 3860 by 2160 at 60 hertz, 420, or 30 hertz at 444. So the
right.
Color specs.
That sounds like a 10 gigabit limit link,
yeah.
If nothing else. And the company I mentioned for their fiber connector, Innos, or Ineos? INNEOS, their real 4K InvisiCable. A $700 kit that includes 75 feet of pre-terminated InvisiCable. You would need power at each end on something that's fiber optic because there's no power being transmitted
right.
over that. But even being pre-terminated, you look at how thin that filament might be. If I were trying to do it just once and never think about it again, I'd consider a fiber link. If you really have to go that far with the connection.
It's messy right now. And shop carefully, that's all I'm going to say.
But for affordable, or at least good options for that HD-based T technology, you can check out Monoprice. They have a whole category of those products.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're going to get good prices from those guys.
If it's 1080p, you're pretty golden.
Oh,
yeah. 4K, you're probably all right. If it's 4K HDR, you've probably got problems.
4K HDR out of a Blu-ray player probably would work because all those discs are done in 420.
Right.
And the TV then converts that back to 444. So,
crazy. It's messy.
Yes.
Shop carefully. That's all we're going to say. Mike writes, hey, AVXL, big fan for a long time. I have a quick question I'd like some trusted advice for. I'm running a pair of LSR-308s as my PC speakers, currently running through an AudioQuest Dragonfly 1.2 via 3.5 millimeter stereo to XLR cable. While it works for now, I'm curious if there's a good, hopefully not break the bank, expensive USB to balance XLR DAC that would provide true balanced outputs. My current setup while using XLRs isn't really balanced. Thank you for the help, Mike.
Ooh.
Most of our audience probably does not see a lot of balanced connectors in their life, balanced or XLR connectors.
It's on premium speakers, premium AVRs.
Well, it's on... So,
I love the connector.
Yeah, we love the connector. So for folks that don't know, JBL's LSR-308s, those are self-powered studio monitors with 8-inch woofers and horn-loaded tweeters. An image control waveguide. Not a
Ooh.
Horn. Pardon me, JBL. And they only offer balanced inputs either via an XLR cable, that's the big one with the three pins, or a quarter-inch balanced TRS jack. That's the other way of doing balanced cables. Balanced means... when you think balance, up until about 95, it was always professional audio. It was studio audio. It
right.
was people running. You know, for example, the headsets that we use to record this have XLR connectors for the microphones. XLR, or I should say balanced connectors that are terminated with XLR connectors. Balanced, wired, balanced. In any case, I'm thinking too much, and I'm still back thinking about YouTube and Instagram business models. Balance means there's three conductors in the connector, three wires in the cable. There's two signal wires plus a separate ground wire, and they reverse the polarity on the two signal wires. And what happens is because essentially both signal wires pick up the noise, because it's inverted, it cancels the noise out. So they are the standard. If you walk into a studio, everything's wired with balance connectors. They are the standard for professional audio production. Our mic headsets use them. They've got a better signal-to-noise ratio. They have much lower impedance signals. They have almost no external noise or distortion. And they really started showing up on consumer audio gear, super high-end consumer audio gear, back in the, I want to say the mid-90s.
Okay.
That's the first time I remember like seeing that, you know, outside of, you know, at that point I was also still working at some guitar magazines and I saw a lot of XL connectors in studios. Mike is actually using professional audio gear. He's using studio monitors. You know, the easiest way I can think of to run balanced outputs to those JBLs would be like a Focusrite Scarlett 2i2, which oddly enough we have on the table right here, because it should have quarter-inch balanced outputs for left and right. That costs $150. It's got a nice DAC.
Nice.
If you want to do something that's a little more audiophile-y, Shit has their Jotunheim, which has $399, which gives you some really nice DAC options. You can get some pretty cool stuff. And Shit does nice work, and their stuff's built in the United States. Generally speaking, if you have balanced outputs between your preamp and your amp, or your DAC and your speakers, or your DAC and your amp, or your DAC and your preamp, or whatever weird combination you're doing, yeah, you should use them. But most people don't really need them, unless you're in a particularly noisy environment, unless you're running cables longer than 20 feet, or some people will say 8 feet. A friend of mine who's an audio professional is like, there's a reason you never see when there's an RCA cable coming out of the back of a turntable, you'll notice it's never longer than like 3 or 4 feet, because at some point around 6 feet is where it starts turning into a really good antenna. So they try to keep that length short. You know, balance should have fewer distortion issues. Under 10 feet, unbalanced cable should probably have a slightly stronger signal, which isn't really a big deal. If you're talking about a digital source, it's running 2.8 volts.
For me, it's like, if you have those connections available on both ends, why not use them?
Absolutely. Because I was laughing because I was...
Blue Jeans cable and order some custom orange and blue cables.
Well, you know, let's talk about that for a second, right? Because I was laughing because I was looking at some photos of like $10,000 and $20,000 amplifiers from manufacturers who I would aspire. Should I hit the lottery or should I someday become a hedge fund manager? These are companies I would divert my cash towards. Almost all of them had both unbalanced RCA connections, right? Your standard RCA jack is two wires, you know, a signal and a ground, and XLR jacks. None of them had XLR only. So I tend to think if it was that big of a difference, it would be, you know, XLR only all the way, but you still run into people who are trying to connect various devices that don't have balanced XLR outputs or balanced outputs to, you know, your $10,000 or $20,000
amplifier. In terms of speakers I've seen with XLR input or balanced inputs.
Yeah.
They tend to be pretty premium, so they're not your typical speaker. And if you're not dealing with a speaker that is providing those balanced inputs, stick with 12 gauge.
Yeah.
American wire gauge, just standard speaker wire is going to be fine for setup.
But most people aren't going to use XLR connectors for their speakers, right?
Right.
That's almost entirely going to be in between the components. Mike's case is interesting because he's using self-powered studio monitors that are designed to go into a production studio. You know, I talked to a friend of mine who does a lot of
installations. Martin Logans I was dealing with that had XLR.
Okay.
Or balanced inputs. So it was, again.
Well, I talked to our friend, you know, Jason Lord down at the Source AV down in Torrance. And, you know, he did studios for a long time before he started doing the home theater stuff. He's like, just tell people to buy Mogami. They don't build for pretty, but it's the standard in recording studios. You don't need $75 cables, you said, with Nutric ends for 18-inch cables from your preamp to amp. You're not getting a bump in performance by spending $250 for your 18-inch XLR cables. The whole reason people buy Mogami cables, you know, like you can pick them up at like, you know, I'm looking at one at Sweetwater for like $40 is because it has virtually no character. What goes in, what comes out.
Right.
It's interesting to look at, like, you know, like I said, as far as I know, one of the least expensive ways to get a set of balanced connectors to those speakers would be a Focusrite. I like it. I've used it a lot as a headphone amplifier and DAC. Shit's Jotunheim has some pretty slick DAC options that are worth looking at, because you can choose that with a multi-bit DAC upgrade. Their standard is the AK4490, which is pretty nice. You can also put a phono preamp inside of that instead of the DAC. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. So, you know, but again, like, yeah, there they are. There's the line outputs right there on the back, the big quarter-inch jacks on the back of that. So you got options. You know, if it works right now, stick with it. If you want to upgrade, you don't have to spend a fortune, Mike. So hope that helps you out a little bit.
Cool.
I forgot to answer this question last week. I apologize. Sir P wrote in, you teased it, but you didn't answer it. When should a preamp be considered and what specs should be looked for? Does it depend on why a preamp is needed? First of all, my apologies. You know, for me, the short answer is I haven't used a preamp or hadn't used a preamp for years until I started playing around with turntables last fall. And I actually needed to boost the output from a phono preamp to a reasonable level for my amplification. Because for me, whether I've been using, you know, anything from like an AudioQuest Dragonfly or some considerably more expensive DACs, I've always almost always used the source as a volume control, and sometimes had to use something like a Shit Sys, which is a passive volume control, to limit the output.
Okay.
I haven't needed to preamplify a signal going into my amplifier for years until, again, I started playing around with a turntable. And the output level from turntables is way lower than any digital source that you're going to run into.
So it's for... Preamps are specifically for devices that don't have built-in amplification.
Well, people, if you walk into a high-end audio store...
I mean, right, I always think of them for microphones.
You always think of them for microphones, but, you know, it's funny because you don't really come out of a stereo geek background, right? So when people say an integrated amplifier, you usually think of, like, a classic piece of 1970s gear with a big knob for changing the FM station or the AM station,
oh, yeah,
right? And another big knob for controlling the volume. And that acted as a, you know, it would probably have a phono preamp built into it, and it would also do amplification for anything else you plugged into the back of that. And this ties into some of the conversations we had with Gordon Rankin earlier this, a while ago, talking about what was the standard volume for digital outputs. You know what I mean? Like, and because the CD standard was much, much higher than the kind of analog standards that came before it.
Okay.
So, again, for me, because my life is so much about digital music, and because when I started getting into stereo gear, it was part of a movement of going from powered preamps to passive preamps and eliminating preamps and eliminating as many devices in the signal path.
Simplify, man.
Yeah, simplify. You know, I've got a really nice McCormick preamp, and I ended up buying an Emotiva, one of their basics and devices, just to sort of simplify some stuff I was experimenting with, because that's a, you know, stereo preamplifier, and it's a DAC, and it's a tuner. And I wanted to play around with a better preamplifier than I currently own, because my McCormick Micro is pretty beat up at this point. So, CRP, if your amp or your source is really low output, if you need a particularly brutal signal or power to get your amplifier to hit full output, if your source is fairly low, i.e. you're running it off a turntable, if you need to switch between multiple sources and you don't want to walk up and unplug and plug a cable in, you know, that's when I start looking for a preamp. Like, so much of my music is, it goes from the computer or the device I stream audio to the amplifier.
Right.
And the device I stream audio to has the DAC built in. You know, if I own a CD player, I haven't used it in 7 or 8 years. But if I wanted to be able to switch between, you know, my Rune audio receiver and my turntable and my CD player, that's a good time to buy a preamp. If you have an analog source like a turntable that needs its level boosted, you need a preamp. That's not a really technical answer, but I think it'll work for most folks.
Cool.
You know, if you want to get more technical, or if you're running tube amps, you know, quotes, a preamp should have an output impedance 1/10 or less of the load. You know, there's some really good articles about how to match a preamp and a power amp. The basic rule of thumb is, if you buy your preamp and your amp from the same manufacturer, you won't have to think about it. If you start mixing and matching, there's some basic rules on how to match preamps and power amps. And if you all are curious about that, since I've probably beaten this horse to death for most of you, do us a favor and email. I believe in eliminating things from the signal path and stereo audio. Not something you're going to do for a home theater, but if you're just doing stereo listening, it might be an attractive idea. Not particularly practical if you're into vinyl or turntable audio.
Very cool.
Moving back to the video side of things, at FXR Scene tweeted an article to us about how HDR is going to kill your OLED TV.
It was an interesting article put together by, I want to say, Mr. Jacoby
over at Tech Hive.
Yeah, over at Tech Hive. And it effectively is saying that, and this information is not readily available in terms of, is driving an OLED screen with very bright content, will it age it faster? And I think the general consensus is, yes, it will. I mean, the harder you drive one of these panels, the more you're stressing those organic materials, you can age them in uneven ways.
Really?
Now, with video content, things are moving constantly, so you're usually not stuck with like static patterns on the screen. But where it can become an issue is, say, a white bug or a channel's graphic that stays on the screen and sits there for a very long period of time, or for everything they show, especially if it's not a transparent graphic, it's a hard white graphic, those kind of things, especially if you're driving the panel at 100% or even in an HDR mode, which in most cases probably wouldn't be the case with regular TV. It is definitely possible. How much that will age that panel? Some say that it can actually decrease the lifespan of the panel by up to 25% or more.
Whoa.
So what's odd about that article is it gets into OLED lighting for rooms versus what they do with TVs. So is the technology comparable? I'm a little doubtful there. These are new technologies that we're still dealing with. We haven't had a decade of OLED experience yet. Is it possible to burn an OLED screen in? I most certainly think so. You can look over at the good ratings folks for their long-term testing, where they are actually trying to burn these screens in. Another viewer named Austin wrote in saying, hey, I've got a question for you about burn-in on OLED TVs. I have a 2017 LG B7A 55-inch OLED, and I can see a faint square that's about 15 by 10 inches right in the middle of the screen. It seems to be most visible during static single-color images, fortunately. Not sure if it's something a warranty would cover. Any suggestions? Would any professional calibration minimize it at all? Going back to the work by the folks at Ratings, one of the things they discovered in their testing of the B7 series, and I believe they have six of them up on a wall, was that they ran into an issue where there was a 25% quote-unquote sized window, which would probably be about 15 by 10 inches on a screen like that, that was visible in certain test patterns. That wasn't something they did. It was just there. And so they had to call in LG's engineers to take a look at it. To quote, it is not an issue with the panel itself. It is possible to apply a fix to the lookup table built into the TV. LG will apply this fix to anyone who presents the issue to their support for free, even after the warranty period has long expired. Now, apparently they fixed two of their affected TVs that had basically a test window used at the factory as soon as the panel came off the hot process that's used to create it. And in this case, they show a 25% window. And apparently if the panel hasn't cooled enough when they show this test pattern, that it can then get integrated into the lookup table of the panel. So doing things like the pixel refresh function on the TV, if you've done that once or twice and suddenly there is a box visible in certain content, well, I would say give LG a call and explain that to them. And they might be able to provide you with a patch or have an engineer come out, load up an updated firmware that should get rid of it. It's a very specific issue, and it sounds like you probably weren't testing 25% windows for, you know, hours on end or days on end. So that's just something to keep in mind. With an issue like that, specific to the B7A panels, I would most certainly get LG on the phone and have a talk with them and say, hey, if there is an update that could possibly address this, I would like to sign up for that and have you come out and do it, especially if it's free. So take advantage of your contacting and get it done. I wouldn't hesitate, really. If it's something that's bugging you and you know exactly how to see it and what shows it as far as the issue goes with that 25% screen that is used in their initial testing at the factory, give LG a call. We were talking also about just, will HDR kill your OLED TV? That article, I would also, it's like, look, OLEDs have become the replacement for plasmas, and they are very plasma-like in terms of their, not only the viewing angles, but uneven image wear is a potential issue with these. I have seen many plasmas burn in, and it is definitely possible to burn in an OLED as well. Even LG had to deal with this at Incheon Airport in Korea, where they had... I even saw this TV too, actually, when I was flying back. In their lounge for certain parts of the airport, they were using the OLED screens to show gate information. So relatively static screens with high contrasted images. The panels they installed are not the same panels that are there today. They had to actually replace all of them because of noticeable burn-in on these panels that people had observed. I do not consider OLEDs, at least as far as consumer TVs, to be commercial signage devices quite yet.
Right.
Yeah, or if you are, just keep everything moving a little bit. Don't leave anything on a screen for long periods of time. That's just detrimental. And in terms of, will HDR kill your OLED TV? I'm going to say absolutely not. Because one thing is that HDR effects aren't the whole screen being lit up at once. It is small, very small portions of the whole screen overall. Usually not the same spot twice. It's not so much of a concern of mine. I would be a little more careful with those compared to, say, LCD panels, of course. And if any of that is a concern for you and your viewing type, maybe you are running a Windows desktop on an OLED panel or something that doesn't change a lot and it has very high contrast elements to it, consider a good LCD then instead. And there are plenty of them out there to choose from. So, but yeah, if you happen to see something roughly 25% of the screen size in your LG B7A that you didn't do, and maybe you didn't notice it, but you did run that pixel refresh function once or twice and it suddenly was visible, that I would say is definitely the trigger then for you to give LG a call and take advantage of this free update for the lookup table software.
Interesting. Seems like there's just going to be a lot of unmasking of, you know, fixable and unfixable oddities in next generation display technology.
Dude, it goes back to the beginning of the show where we were talking about what Samsung's thinking of doing with a blue OLED material. Typically, right. In history, blue has been the hardest color to create with OLED materials. It aged much faster than red or green. I'm really curious to see what some of the new formulations are and how robust they tend to be. And I doubt Samsung's going to introduce an OLED TV until they get that nailed to their satisfaction.
Interesting.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I had mentioned a ska band earlier in the show that I'm laughing at Michael O'Neill, who does the Solopreneur podcast and also does Beginner Audiophile. I occasionally join him on Beginner Audiophile.
Oh, cool.
Our history goes back to, he was from Philly. I was mostly from Jersey and rural north of Philadelphia, but we used to chase this band called Hyperactive, and we have a lot of overlapping taste in music. So
cool.
He had posted a link on Facebook, which oddly enough, I actually found before it disappeared. Band's called Brass Against, and they are, amongst other things, they've been doing ska covers of Rage Against the Machine. The cover of Wake Up's pretty amazing. They've got Bomb Track in there and a bunch of other stuff. Killing in the Name of. I'm a big fan of ska, which you could essentially think of as high-speed reggae, but different. If you've heard,
Hey, I appreciate a fresh take on a song that used to make me drive a lot faster than I probably should. So... Last car accident I got into, actually the only car accident I've been involved in my adult life, was me playing some song that made me drive a little too quick and then traffic locked up in front of me.
Oh my goodness.
It was a gentle tap, but still enough to cause almost no damage to the other vehicle.
That's good. How many points did it cost you?
I think I did traffic school for that one. And my traffic school count has been reset at this point. And yeah. Trust me, I am such a more mellow driver than probably at any other point in my life now. I am not in a hurry for anything.
I should also point out that Tom Morello himself of Rage Against the Machine describes them as a brass band, not a ska band. And they are the Brass Against band. So.
Oh, cool.
You know what? You never know where new music's going to show up. I'm curious if Tidal is still going to be around in another year. They seem to be not doing particularly well as a business, but I've been listening to a lot of Tidal, a lot of Spotify, and just all over the map audio-wise, testing out some stuff and kind of rebuilding my stereo system in a new location and getting ready for one last attempt to prove to myself that vinyl is super audio, super awesome compared to digital. I don't know if that's going to work, but, you know...
I have been doing more streaming audio since I've been taking a look at that Sonos Beam of late. That for me has been, it's been fun kind of rediscovering that. But I tend to stick to, honest to God, Pandora or my network connected storage system that has every CD ripped to a FLAC file. And
which is a pretty awesome way
to
go.
And I'm one of those that one digit percentage of people who still buy audio CDs just for the fact that I can create a file that has no DRM at full quality. And I go out of my way. Plus, there's something about the album art too. The CD jewel case art.
You would like Rune, do that. Because of the way it pulls together album art, not just for Tidal, but for your own audio collection. For me, it's been frustrating, because I started getting Tidal because a bunch of stuff I was looking at wanted to work with Tidal about a year ago, and then I started using Tidal a lot more because my wife and was using our Spotify account at home, and then I couldn't use it at the office. So I started using Tidal a lot more. And I started to realize that Spotify, you know, they both have millions and 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 millions of tracks. But it's amazing how in particular odd corners, I find a lot, Spotify has filled things out a lot better than Tidal has. Or maybe I just have unfortunate taste that don't coincide.
I think it's hard for a lot of people too to justify spending money on multiple music services unless you're just a hardcore fan. And,
yeah.
You know.
I ended up with multiple services because I needed to test multiple services some different devices.
Of a reviewer.
Yeah, it's always interesting, but I'm with you. You know, if I have that Amber Rebarth album on CD ripped to flak, I never have to worry about, you know, Chesky Records pulling everything off of Tidal.
True. I end up with a few storage cases now of various discs, but I can always go back to that if I ever needed it to rebuild a library, which hopefully I'll never ever have to do again. But yeah, I have no problem with CD audio quality and knowing, hopefully it's more directly supporting of the artist as well in terms of that purchase. And besides that, I'm one of those oddballs that have no problem taking that in my own hands. And
yeah.
I don't need to go find the file online and download the whatever it is somebody else made. I want to make that myself.
Yeah, that would seem to be the prudent way of doing it. I'm admiring your stack of Ultra HD Blu-rays, which includes Blade Runner 2049, which I just watched the second time a couple weeks ago.
Some of those I haven't watched at all yet.
Gladiator, I'd be very curious
brand new.
To see in HDR.
I just got that in.
Mad Max Fury Road, Star Wars The Last Jedi. That might be the disc for a while.
Oh, cool.
The HDR demo.
That was the weird one. I have not paid attention to Star Wars since the first six movies, really. So all of these new Star Wars adventures that have come out,
right.
Be it within the canon or those separate one-off stories, I kind of assumed all of that was going to be available in 4K UHD. And so I grabbed the first 4K UHD of the new movies that popped up, and it was The Last Jedi, and then I realized, oh, that's like the second one of the new ones.
Right.
The first one isn't available in 4K UHD, and I was like, why? It's like, I don't... So, yeah, I bought it on Blu-ray, and it's coming, but I know as soon as it comes out in 4K UHD, I'm going to go through that again, and I was really trying to avoid that, but whatever. I do have some good sci-fi, though, to start burning through here as well.
I'm really surprised. Yeah, The Last Jedi is the first 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray.
Yeah. The first one, The Force Awakens, that was the one where I'm like, where's the UHD Blu-ray option here? And it's like, oh, there isn't one. And I'm like, really? Really? So, anyway, they're going to get my money again if they do put out that version in UHD Blu-ray. But yeah. For the time being, just to say, remember, I've seen it.
Disney's slow.
Yeah.
Disney's first ever Ultra HD Blu-ray release, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, August 2017.
Currently on Netflix. Yeah. Although I don't think they have the first movie. I never saw the first movie, so I'm like, I'm not watching Volume 2 until I see Volume 1. So
I can't believe you haven't seen Guardians of the Galaxy. Oh, my goodness. This has been a long and wandering show even for us. I apologize. We tested your patience. And if the show wasn't long enough for you, well, I apologize for that,
I do
too.
Have one quick follow-up.
Quick.
I mentioned a JVC projector calibration I did a while back, and it was for the DLA X990R. I was not satisfied with the final results, and I let the owner know that and offered to go back and redo it, and I did. And this time around, I came armed with the JVC calibration software. I now understand that that is simply a requirement to get optimal performance out of a JVC projector that
really
supports that software. So, things like very detailed gamma setups and corrections cannot be done effectively without that software. And the software effectively acts like a lookup table generator in a sense that it does a pretty detailed setup. You can select a less refined setup or a more extreme setup that
right.
does more points of information for color and gamma and other things like that. However, the results were fantastic.
That's good to say.
My goal was to at least beat this projector's built-in THX mode, which I have to say was very, very well done. It was to the point where I measured it and I was like, well, why bother calibrating it when that preset looks so damn good and it measures almost perfect?
That's a pleasant surprise.
I was quite pleased, actually, given the variety of screen materials you can deal with and how they change the characteristic of the image you see. One oddity, though, and I've mentioned this too, is that that JVC software requires a Spider colorimeter or an i1 Pro version 1 or 2. Those are the only two meters that are compatible with the JVC software. And I all but refuse to ever touch a Spider product again, S-P-Y-D-E-R, simply because it's a little old school for me. And I can't picture calibrating an $8,000 projector with $150 colorimeter. And especially one you have to point. In the case of the Spider, you point it into the lens. You don't point it at the screen. And in the case of the i1 Pro, which I have, I pointed that at the screen, and then I went ahead and confirmed the setup afterwards using Portrait Display's Calman software and my high-end meters. I got to say, yeah, it came out absolutely beautiful. Some of the very lowest color errors I measured, especially in Rec. 709, with any display device I've ever tested. It went from being like meh to like wow, reference grade, and it just jumped out. And I got to say, projectors are complicated beasts with many knobs to twist, and JVCs are similar to any of the other high-end projector, but wow, when they're done, they are some of my absolute favorite display devices, and I'll leave it there.
I think you're smitten.
I
feel comfortable in saying that you were smitten with the JVC
projectors. I'm just pleased that software did as well as it did, given the setup with it. I mean, man, you talk about an equipment layout. I've got a Ethernet cable running to the projector. I have 2 meters pointing at the screen. I got my notebook. I got a signal generator. Multiple pieces of software to make this all work. And I'm telling you, it's like 2 5-hour visits to get this thing looking right.
Right.
And I will say now, going forward, I will definitely use JVC software in the future just to get over that initial hump. And if there's one tip I can throw out there for the JVC calibration software, if somebody's messed with that projector at all, you may as well just factory reset the projector.
And start over again.
Because if any of those settings are have been adjusted and you didn't go back and undo it, well, it could affect your final results. Also, too, for whatever reason, within the JVC software, when I was doing the HDR setup, it defaults to an HDR color space, which turned out to be Rec. 709. It wasn't HD color. And it was like, at first I'm like, why is this looking so weird? And why are the colors so truncated? And I'm like, wait a minute. Go into the menu where it says HDR color. Oh, BT2020. It's like, okay, that should be the damn default. And anyway.
Other than that.
Oh.
Duh. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I got to say, HDR and SDR on that JVC, the DLA X990R. Glorious, glorious looking. And I've also seen very good SDR and HDR out of, you know, less than the top of the line models from JVC as well. It seems like as you step up the chain, like that X990R does have a THX preset calibrated by the THX folks, whereas step down models probably don't. But that's just one of the other value add things they put in there. But
it's nice to have a little value add.
And yeah, thank you to everyone supporting us on Patreon.
Patreon.com/AVXL. Please join the crew that makes the show possible. And if you haven't been there, AVXL.com is the website with the RSS feed and all the other links. But our patrons get access to the show early and they get access to us. You should have an email showing up that tells us when the next tells all of us and you, when the next hangout is. And thank you so much for listening to and supporting the show. I got to scoot because I got to be on another podcast in 4 minutes.
Oh.
My name is Patrick Norton.
I am Robert Herron.
And thank you so much for listening to AVXL.